After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, visit www.beherenownetwork.com/Sharon. Enjoy listening.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm thrilled today to welcome the very talented Alanis Morissette to the Real Love series, right here on the Sharon Salzberg Metta Hour. Alanis Morissette is one of the most influential singer-songwriter musicians in contemporary music, with sales of over 60 million albums worldwide. She's a dedicated advocate of female empowerment, spiritual, psychological, and physical wellness, and the advancement of children's education. Welcome, Alanis.
Hello.
I'm so glad you're here talking to me.
Oh,
I think most of my listeners are really very intense fans of your music, so I thought we might start today with the side of you that people are a little less familiar with, which is outside of the music world. Uh-huh. You're a longtime seeker, as I understand. I've spent a lot of time studying developmental psychology and attachment theory, internal family systems, somatic experiencing, and shadow work, to name a few, as well as a lot of work around addiction and codependence recovery. Can you tell us what started this journey for you and what focus it's currently taking for you?
First of all, I just want to say thank you so much for having me, and it's such an honor to be speaking with you. I just wanted to make sure I said that before I began. I think based on my temperament and my role in my family, to be honest, as a young child, was that of therapist and was that of attempting to control chaos and playing that juicy role in my family. So I started quite young with wanting to understand the human condition for several reasons. One, just because I was innately curious about it, about how we operate and why we're here, et cetera, some of the loftier, more fun questions for me. And then also as a survival strategy to figure out, I thought that if I could figure out why people were behaving in certain ways they were behaving, namely family members, etc., that somehow I could control it, and I could help, you know. So the idea of being of service was intentional for varying reasons, as far back as I can remember, actually. And then for a long time in my career, writing music, I would write the songs initially for myself to gain some level of clarity or understanding, and then I realized that upon sharing it, that people would make these songs their own, and they would use it in whatever way they deemed necessary in that moment in their mm-hmm. life. So it was a very convenient way to be expressed and serviceful at the same time. So I felt really blessed for that.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah. And then in terms of coming to what you just described, for a long time, people were really encouraging me within the industry to pick a lane, so to speak, you know, mm-hmm. to stay in my lane and in some ways remain one-dimensionalized. And even, you know, they would have sort of a reductive view of me, whereas, you know, I'd be wanting to be somewhat academic in moments and psychologically inclined, and I was made fun of for that. And then, of course, there was the rock and roll and all these different aspects of my own personal self that was wanting to be expressed. And it's only been lately in what we call these so-called modern times where it's actually become kind of hip to be integrated and to be more whole in a way. So it's less about cutting parts of myself off depending upon what context I'm in, and more just showing up as who I am regardless of what environment I'm in. It's convenient.
It's very convenient, and it's different.
Say again?
It's very different than it used to be.
Yeah, right? Do you notice that?
Well, I notice it in the realms of meditation or a word like mindfulness or even compassion where, you know, if you were a practitioner, like a serious practitioner, and you were not so much in the arts, but if you were an academic or you were a doctor
therapist,
or something, or a banker, you'd kind of hide it, you know? You
wouldn't
want people
to
know that.
Around it. Yeah,
it was. It was like, oh, you're odd.
You know? Yeah, and even the terms, the disparaging terms they had where it was woo-woo or whatever those words were, it's horrifying. But now it seems to be less and less the case, which is really relaxing.
Yeah, it is very much so.
So relaxing. Good for the nervous system.
Yeah, we belong. Hey,
look at that. Imagine that.
It's great.
It's funny.
So you've been incredibly outspoken about your own personal confrontation with codependency and addiction recovery. And from the Buddhist perspective, desire is named as the first of the five hindrances that affect our experience. And they're hindrances because they're seductive and they promise a lot and deliver a little. Mm. And part of the path of getting free is not so much killing desire, which doesn't actually work, but opening our fields of desire to truer things like friendship or belonging or connection. Mm. Does that resonate with you in your path?
Yeah. Going from the hedonic pleasure aversion, pain avoidance thing to the eudaimonic sort of more engagement flourishing, I think of it in terms of inside out versus outside in, you know, and I appreciate both. I appreciate, you know, us being animals and seeking pleasure, that dopamine kind of hit, I call it a hap hit, you know, and it's like you just said, it's so temporary.
Yeah.
But for me, it's been a combination of, to be perfectly transparent, the bouncing between the both. And I've just noticed that there's more of an ongoing sort of steady current of a felt sense of the truth of who I am from the eudaimonic, less chasing and more grounded, you know, and that might even look like just eyes closed, looking down at the ground while I'm walking if there's mayhem all around me.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, service, you know, as far back as I can remember, my mom especially was very intent on having service be the platform from which all things bound from, you know, so being of service is where I find my greatest sense of well-being. And then the major important caveat for me is to make sure that I take care of my body and that I don't completely obliterate self in order to just show up, you know. And then the developmental immaturity issues, which seems to be more of an accurate way of describing codependence, because codependence has been a term that I think has been misunderstood by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But working with Pia Melody and just looking at self-care and boundaries and being in reality versus fantasy and having a sense of one's own needs and wants and reaching that middle path kind of moderation balance, you know, this is the grand invitation of maturing, and so many ways to get there, you know, whether it's through therapy or through marriage or through friendship, even in my professional environments, you know, I'm constantly being called to grow up, and it's quite a lovely invitation. It's harrowing at times.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, I wrote, my most recent book was called Real Love, and I almost wrote the whole book because of one line in a movie. The movie was Dan in Real Life, which is maybe 10 years old, something like that.
Okay.
And the line is, love is not a feeling, it's an ability.
I love that.
I was so taken with that because it matched my own experiences in meditation practice so strongly, where I saw there's so many ways I thought of love as in someone else's hands, which meant they could bestow it upon me or take it away from me.
Yeah.
And if they took it away, I'd have nothing. Whereas if it was an ability, it was mine. It was inside me. Mine to nurture.
Yes. And if we could add to the word ability, it would be the ability to express who we innately are at our core.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and if we are love at our core, if we are consciousness or light or all these gorgeous words that chase the ineffable, undefinable thing. It's the ability to articulate that, you know, but there's so many messages in culture in general that they don't, even in parenting context, like there's no separation of behavior and the core of who that person innately is.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
The whole idea of being bad or sinners or, you know, someone acts out and all of a sudden they're a bad person, as opposed to in this behavior in this context doesn't work, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I love that. And I think of love as a verb in a way too. You know, because so many relationships broke up because the feeling of infatuation would wane, and then a lot of times I would just be dumped because they didn't feel so loving toward me anymore. I was like, well, that's inevitable in any relationship. There's going to be moments, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's some place in which I guess you yourself have called yourself a love addict.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, like the love addiction is really an addiction toward a person, and I actually would say it's an impersonal person, you know. So it's less about love, it's more about the addiction to an avoidant, you know, someone who seeks intensity outside of the relationship and specifically doesn't want to turn around and meet, you know, and that's their survival strategy. So for me, recovery has been about the underlying issues and the traumas that were underneath the desire to have the dopamine and have the perpetual hunger, as I called it, you know, that would have me choose people who simply couldn't meet me, you know. And I think from what I've learned from my own recovery journey and through Pia Melody is that the love addict seems to want connection, but they're actually very terrified of it. And then the avoidant seems to want to get away and doesn't want connection, but they actually are very vulnerable to being abandoned and rejected too. So there's an equal sort of fraught relationship with the idea of connection. So I've been in recovery for that for a long time, multiple whack-a-mole addictions that have just, depends on which one's abated for a hot second. And so much of it is just the recovery of trauma for me in my past.
I think for everybody, really. I mean, one way I think trauma is sometimes defined is being frozen.
Yes.
You know, it's like all that energy, all that potential.
Yeah.
All that capacity is like locked down. And so,
yes. And it's so bright that it'll depress us or it'll make us sick, you know, and fight, flight, freeze. Then the new ones of collapse. And tend to befriend too. That was a big one for me. As like from a Canadian culture, was when things hit certain fans, that I would just go toward the fire. You know, and I'm like, what am I doing? I'm moving toward the fire. But that was just one of my survival strategies. So
yeah.
So it's just about waking up to survival strategies and that what you just mentioned about. I call it sort of this current of energy within us that is so powerful that courses through us at varying speeds, and that we have to be responsible for it in some way. And if we don't know how to, or if I don't know how to, then it can quickly turn into anxiety and depression and chronic dysregulation. And I don't, our bodies weren't built to be in chronic dysregulation like that.
I think my mood today is such that
how's
I'm thinking, my mood today is such that I think it's a miracle we survive. And, you know, as burdensome and kind of onerous as these survival mechanisms become when they're no longer needed, you know, when we have other options, you know, what a thing. We made it, you know.
No, like, we're still here.
We're still here.
We're still here. We're trying to make it work.
Which is pretty great, you know.
It's
and
awesome.
I think
it's a miracle.
It is a miracle. And the more we like, I've really felt this through my meditation practice and my reading in Buddhism and so on, the more we move away from right and wrong and good and bad to suffering and the end of suffering as how we assess things, you know, things we feel and things we fear and, you know, other people's behavior, the better off we are.
Yeah. I mean, and that sounds so lovely on paper, and it seems to be such a challenging thing to do because on an animal level, we get very limbic and very animal and responsive in that way. And then some, like you said, we get frozen in it, you know. So it's like this thawing where we can get that neofrontal cortex of our brain back online, because it's the potential for what's possible, and it can helm the whole journey. But if we're subject to our survival mechanisms and our animal responses, we'll stay stuck there, you know. And so much anxiety and depression and chronic stress and work addiction in culture today, that has become a whole new element of my, what I what I call my servicefulness, just to touch on that, because our bodies are unrested.
Yes, no, very much so.
Yeah.
I mean, I said to a friend just today, actually, I had breakfast with somebody, and I said, I think you're moving down the chakras, you know? I think you kind of moved from, like, open-heartedness to, like, survival. But you know what? I think you're in the – things are happening in your life that makes sense, you know?
Yeah, because it is circumstantial sometimes. Circumstantial, biochemical, hormonal, you know, neurobiological. It's so many things to take into account. We are these gorgeous, complex creatures with this – this delightful light in the center of it, and we can so easily lose sight of it if one thing is off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
You know, you're so forthright, which is such a gift for people, and you're well known for deeply honest and very personal songwriting. And here I have a quote from one of your songs. You say that most of, well, it's not from your song, it's about the songs. Most of the songs are, in a roundabout way, actually addressed to myself. There's a certain aspect of the songs that's very confessional, very unadulterated. It was a very unfettered spiritual experience.
Mm.
So that's a beautiful and I think very true comment on creativity.
Yeah, the idea of being able to show up and surrender at the same time, you know, so it's being very alert and yet very, it's very feminine for me too, like very receptive, clear the mind completely and just let whatever is to come through in any given moment come through. And like I said earlier, at first it's just for me, you know, and it's a very self-focused, self-expressed thing. And then once it's finished, I completely let go and I let it be other people's interpretations of it. It's always really satisfying for me to hear people's interpretations of any words that I've written. And often it has nothing to do with what I wrote. It's
great.
Great.
Right. What did they hear? How did they hear that?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, I often, you know, like from the time I was a child, I wanted to be a writer. I never actually thought I could. And then I finally did it. And so now I can't stop.
Good. And, we win, by the way. Your audience wins.
Thank you. You know, and it's, I look back at the things I wrote and I think, I don't actually remember writing it.
Right.
You know, which is kind of remarkable.
You were in that zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the use of the mind as a filter. You know, it's like my brain becomes secondary so that I can articulate something or choose words, but the actual message or the current is in the driver's seat. So it's really exciting. I also noticed too, in having performed a lot of the songs, particularly the more sort of angry, emotive. I mean, they're all emotive, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But performing those again and again, what I did notice about art when it's singular, and meaning when it's in a vacuum or when it's being written alone in a studio in my case, is that the process is very cathartic, even performing on stage. But it doesn't become healing for me until it's relational. So, you know, I may have a conflict with someone and then I run away and write about it. And if I never really resolve it within my own self, within a context of therapy or with the person directly, I can sing that song 150,000 times and the catharsis will remain, the movement of energy will remain, but the actual healing experience is still just out of reach for the fact that it's not relational.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big revelation for me around thinking that I could get away with, you know, not interacting with humans. I'll just write songs for the rest of my life and not have to talk to anybody.
It's interesting. Well, rumor has it you're writing a book.
Yes.
Are you written a book?
I'm about 1,200 pages in, and I'm clearly going to need to edit.
I think so.
But you think? A little War and Peace. It's a lot of stories. And for me, you know, the idea of just telling stories in and of itself was never compelling enough without some sort of intentionality of servicefulness imbued into it. So there's some informal and formal and, you know, humor-filled teaching throughout all of it, and it's gotten to that place where now it's just editing itself, it's just writing itself, and that's the flow that I was waiting for. And I truly believe in divine timing, so although I have been talking about this book for way too long in my mind, it is eventually going to be ready over the next year.
That's fantastic. I turned in Real Love 2 years late and 1 day early.
Oh, there you go.
I was extremely proud of them one day. It's like, look, I turned it in early. Like
I was in some sort of divine timing aspect. That's great.
Really?
No, I love that you're writing. It's such a service. It's such a gift.
Thank you. I mean, for me, it's, you know, that form of creativity is very connected to love. You know, it's about connection.
Mm, yeah.
And even if the person is not in the room, I don't tend to imagine the reader or something like that, but I just feel them, you know?
Yes.
I feel there's someone out there.
Yeah, it's very relational when we're writing, right? Because it is, mm-hmm. It's like a dialogue or an exchange. And I'm teaching again at 1440 later in the year, and the title of this particular one is called Connection as a Way of Life.
Uh-huh, oh, wonderful.
And I just love, you know, ever since I was really little, I think that's what started my tendency toward inquiry to this degree. It was feeling the suffering or that rupture of disconnection from my own self or from spirit or God or oneness, consciousness, or feeling the disconnection in relationships and and how what a lie it is, and that's why it feels so terrible. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it just speaks such a lie about the truth of our interconnectivity. So it sounds like from what I've read of yours and from what I sense from you too, that it's this element of connection being the true north is something that we might share. Would you say that?
I would say that absolutely. What are you teaching? I'd love to come to your course.
Early October, October 5 through 12.
We'll check it out.
But,
you know, no, really, for me, connection is everything. I was just telling someone the story about when I started teaching meditation, which was 1974.
Wow.
And I was teaching with friends and colleagues, and the format of our intensive retreats, which is the form we were teaching in, is that you kind of practice all day and there's teacher contact with questions and answers and stuff, but there's one formal lecture every night, and I was too petrified to ever give it.
Mm.
My big fear was that I was going to be sitting up there, my mind would go blank, and I'd just be sitting up there.
Yeah, you could only hope that would happen, right?
But I went through a whole process, and I realized, you know, the whole thing about giving the lecture is about connection.
Mm.
You know, they're not actually sitting out there, you know, waiting for my expertise. They want to feel connected to this process. And it's their own process because they're meditating themselves. And,
wow.
You know, they want some context. They want some sense of a larger sense of connection. And once I got that, then I could give talks.
Wow. And then what did you notice changed in you, even just in your sitting up front? Like what changed? Was it just that you were okay with letting what was to come out of you come out of you? Or what did it look like? How did it change?
It looked a lot like that. And it looked like not having the need to be perfect.
Yeah.
Like if I didn't know how to pronounce something, I'd actually say that. How do you say that word?
That's so,
you know, and it was just us. It wasn't like they're out there, you know,
right,
looking at me, wanting to judge me. It's like, here we are together.
Yeah. Let's engage in this together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Beautiful. Wow, what a service.
And sometimes people tell me, like, who are performers that have a difficult time actually performing, that if they do a kind of loving kindness or compassion practice for the audience, that they get to that same space, you know, that here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably one of my favorite felt experiences in my body is when the audience is just lit up with love and I'm lit up with love. And it, you know, certainly it's wordless in a sense. I mean, there's lyrics, but it's this wordless connection on a macrocosmic level too. So I love the idea of having my consciousness bounce between the micro, tiny, searingly present moments, you know, say with my daughter or my son when we're quiet alone in a hotel room or in our living room, and then bouncing it out to the whole to the whole world, the whole city, the whole country, the whole universe, really. For me, I have to bounce between the two, because if I get too mired in a sense of one, it's like, I don't know, somehow ungrounding for me.
So how is it when you teach at a place like 1440, or, you know, it's such a different format than being on the stage?
Yeah, I get to tap into the more academic, super receptive too. Like there is a silence in the mind, and then I just kind of tune into whose hair might be on fire in the room, or what is the most burning inquiry movement in the room, or, you know, and then I have my agenda, you know, wanting to share with people I think I was born also to just render pithy or to distill somewhat complicated ideas into a palatable, kind of understandable, hopefully understandable way, so that it can people can take that home and use it. You know, so if I say 100 things and one thing is serviceable for someone to take them from B to C on their personal evolutionary alphabet or R to S, you know, then that would be a wonderful thing. So for me, I just it's like throwing it all out with people, and then if there's something that resonates personally to them in any given moment, wonderful. And then getting pieces of feedback as we go along of what people might want to hear more about or less about, or it's such a give and take. You know, it's definitely sitting across from each other in so many ways.
That's fantastic.
Is that your experience too, or
it is very much my experience. And you know, when we first began teaching in this country, it was all in the form of intensive retreat. So that was a little harder to access, and you had to be highly, highly motivated. And these days, when meditation is so much more accessible, it's actually the range of people in the room is pretty broad. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty exciting, you know, just to see this common endeavor and this willingness to go within and to pay attention. Because one of the things I would say about the word connection, for me, it's also very empowering because, you know, it doesn't mean like if you're drinking a cup of tea, you got to trade in the cup of tea for a better cup of tea. It means you have to be present with what is in a very different way.
Yes.
And that is up to us, you know, so that too is very empowering in the sense that love is an ability.
Yes. Yeah. And there's not that sort of rough resistance, you know. It's like the resistance is so physically exhausting for me.
Yeah.
You know, so when there's that searing presence with what is and not fighting it, you know, and then if there is some behavioral or some circumstantial thing to be shifted, it will be born from that, right?
Mm-hmm,
It's yeah, I mean, I say this as though I do it every day. I aspire. But yeah, the interpersonal muscle of going within, you know, it's sensation for those of us who are particularly highly sensitive temperamentally or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
It can be so overwhelming and overstimulating in a way. So for me, it's cultivating that interiority muscle and that interpersonal muscle, but it's also for me pacing myself. And I used to be really hard on myself around seeking distraction. You know, I just thought, okay, I've got this whole perfectionistic thing that you touched on a second ago, like wanting to be mindful, wanting to be present, wanting to not check out, wanting, you know, and all of these mandates that I had for myself, but just realizing that whatever's happening right now, including my dissociation, you know, it can also be included in that sort of compassionate observation, and including when I'm not so compassionately observing, you know, that voice that can be so cruel, you know, just watching that voice and going, ah, this voice has some goal here, some agenda, usually of protection, you know, trying to protect me or you know, guide me somewhere where it thinks I'll be safer in its own, from its own perception. But I just love how multitudinous the whole internal landscape is, you know, and then every once in a while I have to watch Bart Simpson just to take
away. Yeah,
you know.
I love that, really. So, you know, I usually... And also being a lover of language, you know, many times, many, many times people will say to me, how can I stay mindful after this retreat? Or how can I keep mindfulness all day long at work? And my response is, you're not going to, you know, that's not going to happen.
God bless you.
You know, but you're going to learn how to begin again. You're going to learn how to come back. You're going to learn how to start over more gracefully with a better lightness of heart, you know. And that's the whole point, you know, to think that something's going to happen you're going to be able to hold on to is a big mistake.
Yeah, and it's still that, it's going through that perfectionistic filter, right? It's like somehow that there's some idealized end point or some finish line whereby when we reach it, then, you know, my fantasy was always such that I thought that I'd get to this so-called finish line and that somehow I'd be regulated, you know, I'd have social well-being, positive feelings, life satisfaction, physical health, no depression, no anxiety, no stress. You know, I was just like, okay, well, that might be the case when I'm not in my body anymore, but there's so many experiences being in the body and and coming back to it, like you just said, and saying, okay, what's happening now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was the primary and maybe most important lesson of meditation practice for me was you can start over.
Mm.
You can begin again, you know, like nothing is like unalterably ruined.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine.
Yeah.
Can you say that again, that last couple words?
I said nothing is unalterably ruined.
Ah, yeah.
You know, that, look at that. You know, maybe there's lessons learned or amends to be made or whatever, but everybody makes mistakes, you know?
Yeah.
So let's learn how to let go and come back.
Yeah. And that some of these sensations and, you know, feelings and thoughts that are thinking us and the feelings in the chest or the throat, you know, that a lot of them have messages, you know, of something. And, you know, being responsible and listening to them, not acting on them immediately, but just really attempting to see what messages they may be attempting to give me. But I, you know, my challenge has been that they're so intense that there's an urgency, and that's why writing's been so powerful for me, because when these feelings and sensations and multiple thoughts happen, as soon as I start writing them down and questioning them or even expressing them through art, it takes the power out of them a little bit. It sort of softens it all a bit.
That's so great. Mm. I mean, it's almost like a holistic, one's whole life is like the creative medium, you know, and anything you do toward healing has a place.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't have to be only meditation or, you know.
Yeah, there's so many portals to that felt sense of connection. You know, sometimes it's bottom up through the body, sometimes it's through the intellect, through some flash of insight, through movement, you know, through painting, through teaching, and I mean, there's so many ways. And then I notice that I quickly get depressed when I don't move that energy, or sometimes when I say move that energy, it can look like me sitting still in meditation. That's a version of moving the energy, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have a personal meditation practice.
I do. I kind of consider them, some of them are really formal, as in, you know, sitting down and in silence, watching the thoughts as gently as possible, as witnessly as possible.
That's great.
And then other forms of meditation, walking and even just relational meditation, observing and being fully present and attempting to be as great of a listener as I can be is a form of meditation for me. Spending time with my kids, just really being there for a friend sitting across from me feels like a meditation, you know. And just being in that witness or that awareness, consciousness state, I'm not always there. I could be really identified with my thoughts and my egoic identity and my mind a lot. And then, you know, then my body starts cramping up and I'm like, oh, there's a good gauge.
Yeah, there's a very good gauge, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking that something we were talking about earlier went through my mind and came and went. But something about relating to oneself in a certain way with that fullness of open-heartedness and just presence is, and just that connection is really about relationships as well, you know, where I keep using the example of talking to a stranger and not really paying attention and not really listening or not really looking at them. And if we realize that, we can actually gather our energy and fully arrive and actually be there. And somebody said to me, well, it's the same with long-term relationships. You know, you don't really listen anymore.
Right.
And you know how everything's going to end and, you know, whether it's a friendship or whatever. And,
right.
And I think that is so true, you know, that so much depends just on the quality of our attention.
Yeah, and that beginner's mind, as though we're aliens that landed on Earth, and all of a sudden, boom, I'm in this room, you know, and whoa, look at that bottle. What is that?
Yeah.
You know, and then that movement. You know, I'm often fascinated with the movement toward definition. You know, like I can be having a direct experience of a sunset or looking at a blanket or, you know, and then all of a sudden the word blanket. Oh, and I got that in Mississippi. You know, and just all the stories that kind of, they're desperately wanting to swoop in like an egoic movement that just wants to scoop it all away and define it and concretize it and one-dimensionalize it and move on. You know, it's violent sometimes, and it's entertaining too, though.
Yeah, it is. Just look at that. There's so much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So when you say love is a verb, which I would also agree with,
It can be a verb. I mean, there's so many. It's so fun to chase defining love. You know, sometimes I call it a verb. Sometimes I call it a. It can be a felt sense too. You know, and for me in the body, it's not singularly that though. And then I also draw it a lot in because I can't draw. It was not a gift I was given, but I can draw stick people really well. So I draw two stick people facing each other, and one is saying in the talk bubble. One says you. And then the other stick figure says, no, you. And that's how I define love a lot when I have a piece of paper in front of me. But just for me, it's about expressing with each other, having the direct experience with each other of who we actually are.
Uh-huh.
You know, consciousness meeting consciousness, love meeting love, awareness meeting awareness, light blending into light, you know, and there's so many ways to do it. That's why it's so fun to be here and why I'm still okay with being in a body.
Yeah.
Because there's so many ways to do that.
I mean, it just perpetually blows me away that everything we go through and still, you know, our hearts move toward love. And that's what we, it's almost like, you know, plant in the sun. It's like we just move there.
Yeah. And we get through that cement if we have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if we don't, you know, for those of us who feel stuck and under the cement still and that perfect little weed has not come out yet, you know, that there's still the movement toward it.
Yes.
You know, it's still trying to find the crack.
Yeah, and maybe the crack will find us, you know.
Yeah. Yes, thank you for that.
thank you. So I'm going to finish in a way by reading something of yours that feels so on point and is actually quite Buddhist, where you said, the truth of who we are is innate goodness, and the whole journey is really about removing any obstacles or false belief that keeps us from knowing that.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to have confidence in, you know, for many people.
Yeah, and when you say confidence, you mean to live by that, you mean? Or
to live by it, or even, you know, people often say, innate goodness, you know, like one of my Tibetan teachers, you know, kind of playing with the language, has come to say innate okayness, you know, because goodness was
so
like
fraught.
A bridge too far, you know.
Well, I think what's happened is that in this realm of dualism, we have everything. We have our tall and short. We have our cold and hot. We have all that. So, and that's fun in terms of it, of this playground being, you know, a playground of relativity and dualism.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing, and I struggled with this for a long time, the one thing that I believe is not subject to dualism is the core truth of love and peace and joy and light that we are. So as many, you know, I'm so Jungian oriented and shadow and parts process, internal family systems oriented. The one thing that can't be subject to this dual, to the gorgeousness and violence of dualism is this innate okayness or goodness or light, you know, and even having a word attempt to shape it is comical and sweet, and fun. So that's the one thing that's not subject to it. And I think the word good is so fraught these days because it goes hand in hand with its bedfellow bad, you know.
Yeah.
So if we could just take those words out, that would be so convenient.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really agree with you, and it's very beautiful. It's very beautiful perspective on life. I think it in Buddhism, when they say everybody wants to be happy, you know, it's and everybody has a capacity for wholeness and clarity and connection and care. Everybody has that, and it's usually kind of covered over and hard to find and maybe hard to trust, but it's absolutely there. It could never ever be destroyed. But, you know, as people often counter that with, you know, there's so much violence and there's so much exploitation and, you know, how can you say we are innately good, you know, that but I really do believe that, you know.
Well, I think the violence is the protest from about the lie of us not being good.
And yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you.
No. Please go on.
Yeah, I think words do get us into trouble as much as I love them, because the good and the bad and the, you know, the acting's out, you know, that I keep thinking of the acting's out of the violence and the murder and the, you know, I just think of it as a protest. It's a protest around the lie of us not being aware or given the credence for the truth of who we are, which is this light, you know, these miracles walking around. And so much of it is affected by the body, too. You know, like I said, like we talked about a few minutes ago, with the brain and the biochemical and the, you know, there's so many elements that one synapse or one neural firing that tweaks, and all of a sudden our behavior can change, and we think we're our behavior. And certainly behavior, you know, there's some boundaries being set around them, especially in children or people who are acting out in ways that are really violent, but it's still behavior. It's not the core of who we are.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Oh.
So on that note, I hope I get to meet you, like really meet you. I mean,
yeah,
I feel like I really met you, but, you know, in the body.
Yeah, in the body, eyeballs to eyeballs. I would love to have snacks with you.
That'd be great. So,
and thank you so much for having me. I'm just doing a quiet bow to you. I love this conversation. Thank you for inviting
me. Thank you so much, and I can't wait to see your book.
Yay. Can't wait to keep reading yours. Thank
great.
You.
Great. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Sharon's many offerings and her teaching schedule, please visit her website at sharonsalzberg.com.